I can endure a lot of things, like long excruciating runs and dental work done without anesthesia, no problem. But one thing I can't tolerate is crappy coffee, which is why I only drink Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's completely flexible and customizable, and will make sure you never run out of fresh coffee again. And because you are one of our loyal listeners, Sparkplug is offering you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, film freaksters, and thank you very much for downloading the 402nd Ellis's Analysis. We carp about movie classics from ages ago, and we spoil the crap out of them. We've done that over 400 times, so you should scroll back and see just how many of your favorite films are in our archives. I'm the guy who never had the stamina for marathon running, or even length of the block running, Ryan Ellis. And here's the white, well, blonde angel, who really didn't like watching the dental scenes in this movie, my wife Bev.
That's me.
It was not safe for her eyes.
I have trauma.
And you did not know really anything about those scenes until I sort of spoiled it last week with a coming attractions trivia question, which I'll get to in a second, or opinion question, I guess.
Yeah, I went into this movie more blind than almost any other movie we've ever seen. For some reason, I have managed to avoid any and all spoilers about Marathon Man until you, sir, spoiled a little bit.
That there are scenes like that in this movie. I mentioned to Chris when we did our trivia night, so Chris DiGregorio from Scoring at the Movies, that we were going to watch this when we did the trivia, and he said, oh, not a movie I want to see ever again. Freaked him out just to hear about it. Well, anyway, before we get going to the podcast, it's a holiday here in Canada today, August 2nd, but here we are. We don't plan to take a week off until Thanksgiving in October, Canadian Thanksgiving, but that could change because we're moving in September, moving again, our third move together, right? Fourth different place, third move. Okay, yeah. Fourth move. Anyway, we didn't have the podcast the first time we moved, so our third move as a podcast team. We hope in September, by the way. Maybe not, but that's the plan. And we might need the time to focus on that. So stay tuned if we don't have an episode at some point in September or early October. But the plan is to go until Thanksgiving weekend before we're off again. And we're also about to talk about a movie that has a lot of running in it, right in the height of the Olympics. Wasn't really intentional. I didn't realize that until today preparing for the podcast. I didn't really pick it for that reason, but here we are.
Well, the two runners that he has on his wall are both Olympic champions. Mm. So there's our thin thread of a connection there.
Sometimes I fall ass backwards into things, like this time. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for Marathon Man. What's the worst torture in Dustin Hoffman's 1970s movies? These are some I chose. There are other movies he made in the 70s. Repeatedly getting arrested for obscene language and then getting hooked on drugs and Lenny. Spending years in a brutal jail and having to be friends with Steve McQueen and Papillon. Nearly everything that happens in Straw Dogs, especially to his wife, not even so much him, but him too. The infamous Is It Safe dental scenes in this movie, Marathon Man. Or is it having to spend all your waking moments with a six-year-old in Kramer versus Kramer?
Well, I am horrified by the thought of being responsible for a child.
So that's your answer?
I just can't. No, no, can't be. Because that kid's too sweet and that movie warms my heart too much and I love their relationship too much by the end.
I want my mother.
All right now. So I'm just going to go rogue and say it's the excruciating awkwardness of the last scene of The Graduate. Although that's the 60s.
That's the 60s.
Okay, then I'll say Straw Dogs because, well, Chris says he can never watch Marathon Man again. Straw Dogs, to me, is so much worse. I mean, in the sense that it's better. It's an amazing film that makes me want to turn inside out when I think about everything that takes place in it.
Especially the rape of Amy.
I mean, that is a complicated scene, but actually it's the bear trap, I think, that gets me more than anything.
Okay, right. Have you seen the remake?
No, I didn't bother. Why remake that film?
It's about at the same level. Not the same level. That's not really fair. It isn't that different a movie. Let's put it that way. Which then begs the question, why make it if you're going to make the exact same movie? And it wasn't exactly the same, but it was pretty close to it. James Marsden, Kate Bosworth, and
Alexander Skarsgård.
That's right. He is the former boyfriend. I think one of the biggest differences actually in that version is their relationship is more complex and complicated. Straw Dogs is 50 years old this year. We could have covered it. We're not really going to, I don't think, but here we are talking about it for a little while now. One of the great things about a movie podcast is you can talk about other films during another film.
I feel like my resistance to talking about Straw Dogs is I just don't want to ever talk about that rape scene. For several reasons, one of which is that it's just too complicated to talk about in 2021.
I don't think we've ever covered another Sam Peckinpah movie after The Wild Bunch, which was on the Top 100 Project, the original list. I guess that could have been one, but it's not going to be this year. But Marathon Man is. So, the I Hope You Have Dental Insurance movie was released by Paramount 45 years ago on October 8th, 1976. It cost a bunch of money, and it also made a bunch of money. But the movie is 45 years old now, Bev, so please remind everyone what it's about with the Marathon Man. Is it safe? Is it safe? If you said it like that, that'd be more of a horror movie than this. It's so matter of fact. Is it safe? It's always the same tone, actually,
I think. But that's what makes it menacing.
Yeah. And Hoffman has no idea why he's asking. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Dustin Hoffman is Thomas Babe Levy, a history grad student and avid long-distance runner. Unbeknownst to Babe, his brother Doc is a shady government agent who's working with a Nazi war criminal who's been hiding for decades in South America. When things go sideways with the diamond smuggling operation, Doc brings trouble right to Babe's front door, and he gets caught up in their cruel web. In order to escape from these unscrupulous villains, Babe must test his levels of endurance and match their ruthlessness.
Or, in a nutshell, student taints New York's freshwater supply with literal blood diamonds.
And his gun in the end, too.
And also a man's body.
Yeah.
Not really his fault. Well, it is his fault, I guess. That is supposed to be drinking water, I think. So, way to go, guys.
It is the water treatment facility. But it's funny you mentioned that he accidentally kills himself, Dr.
Gel.
That was a departure from the book, and apparently it was a bit of a controversy. William Goldman was quite upset about that change. In the original version, Babe kills him. He kills him in Central Park in front of witnesses and then just gives himself up to the police right away. But they wanted to tone it down to, I guess, make Babe more of a less complicated hero, because he does get pretty dark in this movie, but he never crosses that line.
Who could blame him if he had, though?
And it's a movie that doesn't really pull its punches in other ways, but they did have to pull their punches throughout the process between writing and screenings, where they cut out a lot of the more violent footage, which is hard to believe because this is a very dark and violent and pessimistic movie, even by 70s standards.
A lot of the dental scenes were cut down, and there were more violent scenes with Roy Scheider. Maybe the time when he's attacked in his hotel room and kills that guy by breaking his back or his neck. But they did cut a lot of that stuff down. And even though the dental scenes are so hard to watch, it is one of those movies where it's suggestive. Like the scene in Reservoir Dogs, the ear-cutting scene. And name a whole bunch of other ones where you think, oh my God, Seven. I saw that girl's head in the box. No, you didn't. You think you did. And you don't see a single moment where a dental appliance touches Dustin Hoffman's teeth.
We always say that movies only get a hard time about the violence in them when the filmmakers decide to show the true effects of violence. You know, you could kill people backwards and forwards. They could get shot and grunt and die.
But no blood.
There's no blood. But if you show somebody in pain, or you show somebody horrified by the death of someone, that is interpreted as a much more violent movie, even if you don't actually see the violence on screen.
I love Jaws. I've seen it so many times. My favorite movie. But the more effective death, maybe because it's the opening scene and one of the more famous deaths in any movie, is Chrissy. But there's not a drop of blood in her death scene, but it's because she's screaming in pain. And yes, so is Quint at the end, and he is bloody, but then the shark's just right there. It's more in your face what's really happening. You know you're going to a shark movie, so you know what actually killed Chrissy. But even now, for all the times I've seen that movie, it still freaks me out because she's screaming in either legit or good acting pain, depending on what you know about the behind-the-scenes making of that movie with the cables they were using to pull her around in the water.
Whatever got that performance out of her, her fear is palpable.
And by the way, about not pulling your punches, Straw Dogs again, 5 years earlier, awfully violent. Although I think, again, it's more suggestive in some ways, but there's more direct, awful, in-your-face violence in that than there is in this, as far as what you actually see. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on Marathon Man. The exact same number of critics and audiences on Rotten Tomatoes liked it. 81% of them both. The average was 7.3 out of 10 on the strength of 42 reviews. Not that many, but it is a pretty old movie. It was nominated for only one Oscar. That was Laurence Olivier with his only ever Best Supporting Actor nomination. He was nominated lots of times for Best Actor. He did win an Oscar for Hamlet in the lead category, and he won two honorary Oscars over his career, too. So he had three trophies in total, but did not win this year. Dustin Hoffman and William Goldman, so the performance and the screenplay, were nominated by other awards bodies, though. As far as the AFI stuff, some pretty strong numbers here. It was 70th on the top 100 quotes with, you can guess it, "Is it safe?" "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." The number one quote, yeah, I never thought that was the best quote of all time, not even close. Marathon Man was 50th on the top 100 thrills. Psycho was number one. I watched that again recently, by the way. It's on Netflix. Don't watch that on Netflix. It looks terrible.
Really?
A, it's 4x3, and B, what a dreadful looking print.
Wow, shame on them.
And anyway, back to Marathon Man's AFI stuff. Christian Zell, so Olivia's character, was 34th on the top 50 villains. Hannibal Lecter, I guess they have some similarities, don't they, was number one. The terrible screaming of the lambs. Okay, anyway, you've never seen this movie before. We watched it about 5 days ago. What'd you think of Marathon Man? Although, as we get into this, it'll also be a movie you could call The Method Man, meaning Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, I really liked it. The suspense and action are so effective. Kudos to Schlesinger, the director, for crafting these exquisite and painfully tense scenes. And for all the praise that Olivier gets for his menacing villain, I really think it's Hoffman's film through and through, beginning to end. He's incredible.
We've now covered him at least seven times. Maybe I missed something, but the four AFI films, The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, also John Schlesinger directed that, All the President's Men, and Tootsie.
And didn't Goldman also write All the President's Men?
Yes, he did. He wrote that too, right. And then Hoffman, for that matter, we also covered in Wag the Dog and Rain Man. I could be missing something, but that's at least now seven movies we've covered him. I know he is broken for everybody, or was a couple of years ago. That's one of those ones, along with Morgan Freeman, that just went...
Yeah, because the accusations were just that he was being insensitive, not that he's a criminal.
George H.W. Bush was the same kind of thing. I think it's one of those old school, old guy, I'm tweaking your butt. It should never have happened. It wasn't cool, but it's not the reason to end somebody's career. But Hoffman has not worked in a while, but he does have some things in the works, but he didn't for the longest time. And I think at least part of that was all this stuff. But he's also 84 years old, I think, this year.
Yeah. With him and with Morgan Freeman, I don't feel like they were going for the jugular. They were kind of in that mix, but I don't remember people really coming for them that hard.
More of a finger wag, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
For me, this movie is strong. We own the DVD. We watched it on Canopy again. It's a goldmine for us lately, and it will be a few more times before the summer's over. I wouldn't put it on my top five of 76. That was a very good year for movies. 75 was probably even better, but 76 had some great entries, including AFI movies. Rocky, Taxi Driver, All the President's Men, Network, maybe the best of all of those. And I love the other ones I just said. Carrie, The Omen, we've covered those two horror movies a long time ago. Very strong year for films. This would maybe make my top 10, not the top five. But the poster says, simply, a thriller. And it is that. It's a very thrilling film. I wonder how you would have felt about it if you didn't know that there was some kind of dental torture coming on. You didn't know who was going to get it. I guess you could figure out who would do it at some point, because Olivier is... Although, is it not right before he does it? When William Devane comes in and pretends like he's saving Hoffman and fakes the assault
great twist
on those
didn't
other guys,
see it coming.
Drives him around. One of the best examples of exposition you'll see in a movie, where he's telling Babe so many things that we need to know. Babe doesn't need to know. Why are you telling him this stuff? Except maybe Babe would reveal what he knows, if he knows anything, when he has this frenzied guy in the front seat that he thinks is a good guy telling him all this stuff. But then it's just a front, because he basically drives in a circle, and Janeway takes him back to that exact same warehouse for more torture. And then Zell plays more of the good cop, and he also exposits a little bit more. But in that scene in the car, Janeway is telling Babe all about who this guy is and what he did. That's how we find out these things. But rather than some lame, boring exposition, it's, what do you know? This guy did these things in the war. He got all these diamonds and all this gold. What else do you know? Swerve around a corner.
Yeah, amazing.
And surprising from someone like John Schlesinger, because his resume is not really filled, as I can see, with thrillers. We talked about Midnight Cowboy. It's a drama. Not really thrilling, exactly.
No.
He did Darling with Julie Christie in the 60s. I think there's just a character study kind of film. That's the kind of director that Schlesinger was. He was almost miscast as this director, although he did a very good job. I just mean that it wouldn't be an obvious choice in the mid-70s to use him as the director. Robert Evans, the legendary Robert Evans, produced this film. He's on the making of. I didn't watch it this time because I didn't need to. I've seen it several times. We'll get to a story that's been talked about with this movie several times over with Hoffman and Olivier. But the thing I always remember from that making of, in addition to that other story, is when Robert Evans said, "We got all our top choices." Okay, Dustin Hoffman, makes perfect sense. Huge star in the 70s. Olivier, absolute legend, makes perfect sense. Although he wasn't German, but okay, fine. Roy Scheider, not an obvious choice, but coming off of Jaws and The French Connection not that long before. Yeah, a couple
and he
of
kills
thrillers.
It. He's perfect.
He's very good. And he's in more of the movie than I remember. I thought maybe he was in 20, 30 minutes. He's in about an hour of the movie. Doesn't die till the hour mark, I should say. But the one that always makes me laugh is Marta Keller.
Now they wanted Julie Christie.
Marta Keller's not your first choice. No. I don't even know who that was. Her resume in the rest of the 70s, Black Sunday, pretty good thriller, Bobby Deerfield, big failure with Al Pacino, and Fedora, a movie that nobody remembers that Billy Wilder made, I think with William Holden, actually. What a decade for we got our first choice, Marta Keller. Your first choice? Come on. Although she is actually Swiss, so that makes some sense because she's supposed to be Swiss, but then she's probably actually a German, as we find out.
I think she's wonderful in the movie, too. I think she's very well cast.
Okay. But I just love that story that we got all our first choices. And I think he even mentions her by name. She wasn't your first choice. You said Julie Christie, huh?
It was like in the IMDb trivia, I think, that Julie Christie was their first choice. He worked with her in Darling, and there was some scheduling conflict or something. I can't remember what it was, but Marta was their second choice.
Christie wasn't really into these kinds of movies anyway. I think I told a story maybe on McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but how she said to Warren Beatty when they were doing Heaven Can Wait, which was a fairly inconsequential film, but very well liked at the time and huge Oscar nominations. There's a scene where she and Beatty are walking together and music was going to play over it so they can say whatever they want to. The lip readers would figure it out, though. And apparently she was saying, "Why are you doing stupid bullshit like this, Warren? Come on, do something that actually means something." And she might have thought the same way about Marathon Man. But the funny thing is, there is some pretty good subtext here.
Yeah.
Because you've got the Jews versus the Germans, the war being fought all over again in a way, 30 years later. Maybe in some ways the war never really ended for particularly Zell, I guess, sitting and stewing in South America all that time. You've also got, more on the early part of the movie, but the underpinning story of many strikes in New York City in the mid-70s.
Injustice is a huge theme throughout the film in the micro sense of what's happening to Babe and how none of that is his fault. And in the macro sense, that they're living in a world that's crumbling, falling apart, and the people who are suffering are trying to uprise and fight against it.
You said during our screening, too, that this is the Taxi Driver universe in the same year as Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
There's a taxi scene at one point. It could have been Travis Bickle driving Babe around. But the other subtext plays off of what we've already said, which is just simply rich versus poor. Look at the diamonds in there. When Babe has thrown them around in the water treatment plant, let's say there's 50, 100 diamonds in there. He could throw away most of them. And Zell, as an older man, could still live very well for the rest of his life. He doesn't even need 10 of those.
And the way
he
reacts to the diamonds being thrown, like you said, this is an old man. I think he says that he has... Oh, no, this disorder just makes it hard for him to read. That's what it is. But he is an old man. He's not going to live all that much longer. Take what you can fit in your pocket. The end.
Why well, he has to swallow them, though. That's what Babe makes him do.
Just swallow them.
And as you pointed out when we saw the scene, it can't be that hard to swallow a diamond. They're not that big.
I've seen Maria Full of Grace. You can swallow a lot more diamonds than one. I don't know what he's afraid of, that it's going to cut up his guts or something. Maybe that's the implication there. But it is so radical when Babe just casually throws the diamonds into the water. It's this brilliant reversal that the MacGuffin of the whole film is pointless in the end. And we're all kind of forced in that moment to reckon with why we might have considered any violence justifiable for the sake of riches.
That this old Nazi asshole ripped out of people's teeth and probably from their bodies.
Stole although from their possessions, sure, yeah.
Primarily from their teeth, I guess, though.
Well, not the diamonds.
The gold, yeah, because that was gold. Maybe that's what the exposition was in the cab with Janeway, but he stole from the teeth first. Then he went on to taking their diamonds. I'm not really sure how he did that if he didn't have frontline access to them the way that the soldiers would have. But I point out to you when we saw the movie, I'm not criticizing the storyline here, but it's a subtext I never thought of before, which is he hoarded all these diamonds for all these years. And if he's a good Nazi, he could have helped fund the war. Wouldn't have changed anything, probably.
Well, the war was over when he fled.
He was doing this for a long time, though.
Yeah, and he could have funded all kinds of things in general to help the cause, but I don't think he cared about the cause. I think he's
that's
just supposed
what I think
to be a psychopathic sadist.
Smart on William Goldman's part. That's a subtext maybe that's going on that isn't really supposed to be anything close to on the surface. I never thought about before, but it makes sense that this guy actually gave any kind of shit about the cause. He would have helped the cause, but he was only out for himself. And he only comes out of hiding from South America after about 30 years when his brother's killed, and he's not believing anymore that Doc and Janeway and those guys are going to work with him. They've been working contentiously for a long time. Obviously, there's a lot of acrimony there.
He comes out of hiding. He puts himself in danger just because he's afraid they're going to rob him. Mm. And everything he's doing is just so that he can keep his fortune. and keep his comfortable lifestyle. Where is he living? Uruguay?
Argentina, something like that. Yeah. Somewhere in South America.
This movie's incredibly cynical. The cynical, nihilistic films of the 70s are really feeling more relevant lately because there's barely a shred of faith left in our leaders, and we're all helplessly watching the world crumble under its own corruption, much like Babe. So there were probably times in the last 45 years that this film has seemed needlessly pessimistic, but I say that this worldview is coming full circle, and I feel right at home in this world right about now. But it is an incredibly cynical movie. It's a very angry movie. Mm-hmm. So many people are not just motivated by anger, but almost driven mad by anger. You know, it starts with that road rage scene, which is insane. A man's car won't start. Mm-hmm. And
get out of the way!
Yeah, he's ramming
I'm trying to.
Him.
Get out of the way! I'm still trying to. Well, I'm really mad at you!
Runs into his car. That's how the whole thing starts. And then they discover that one is German and the other is a Jew. And so they start arguing about anti-Semitism. And all those old grudges come out. And that's why the road rage turns deadly. And then a twin scene takes place when we see Babe, who, as far as we know, has no real reason to be that angry. And he's just running in the park.
He's angry because of his dad.
He's angry because of his dad, and he's angry because he's angry. Because the world gives him lots of reasons to be angry. Because he's orphaned by both of his parents over what he sees as a miscarriage of justice. We said before, injustice, another huge theme in the film. And because he has no mother, and his brother lives somewhere else, and he's
Which what
lonely,
he thinks is an oil executive making a lot of money. And Babe is struggling in New York City. This is one time where, yes, he's miscast in The Graduate because of his age, even though he's great in that movie. And I'm not a huge fan of the movie, but I think he does a great job in that role, even though he's way too old for it. And this, he's too old as well. Obviously,
he's
that much older.
When they were shooting it.
But you can make the argument that you could go back to school after doing something else for a long time because
it's
you
want
to get grad school to be a history major. And what he's going to do with that? I don't know. Maybe be a teacher, I guess. Maybe there's a logic there. But that's the explanation you could easily make for why this guy, who is not that far from middle age in reality, mm-hmm. and he doesn't look that old anyway. Hoffman, I don't think, looked that old in The Graduate or in this. But we know he was, that he was around 30 and then around 40 in the
and
two different movies.
And I assume he's supposed to be Jewish as well. His last name is Levy.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things going on here. I saw on either Wikipedia or IMDb when Zell says something about his father in their standoff scene at the very end in the water treatment plant. Why would Zell mention that? Maybe he knew Levy somehow. Although why he would have been involved in any of that through the 50s, 60s, and in the early 70s when he's hiding out in South America, I don't know. It could just be that he knows about him through Doc, which would make some sense because he's been dealing with Doc and Janeway and probably other people for a very long time. But there's that paranoia too. How do you know about my father? Which I don't think is actually brought up by Babe. But he could have said, what are you talking about? Because Babe always felt bad. Not guilty. He knows it's not his fault. His father blew his own head off. Although that's the story. Maybe that's not true. Maybe it was the Nazis that did it. But it was a communist witch hunt. So it wasn't about the Nazis exactly. It was about that stupid crap in the 50s and into the 60s that America was doing it to itself, like they're doing now. We let the Russians almost win in the 50s and 60s by tearing yourselves apart over something dumb like that. Okay, yes. That would have mattered in the State Department, which is what we see in Manchurian Candidate. There are 175 communists in the State Department. That's more important than Hollywood. Although Hollywood has more power than we like to think because they do influence people's minds.
It's just because McCarthy was lying about how many people were
in the State Department. But he was lying. And now look at it now. Liberals? I'd rather be a Russian than a liberal. Well, then maybe your country that you worship so much, you stupid idiots, is going to go by the wayside if you keep this kind of crap up rather than come together. But we can't do that, can we? We can't be grown-ups. But there's paranoia then. There's certainly paranoia now. And not for very good reasons.
Yeah, a lot of the themes in this movie feel like they're so relevant now. So I read more than once people interpret that last line as the suggestion that his father was actually murdered by Zell, was somehow involved in the same sort of thing that Doc was, and that maybe that's how Doc got into that world.
Could have
been
Zell's brother.
Sure, yeah.
Because he's there.
I say murdered by Zell, but I mean like murdered by those people. Yeah, he was in that same messy quagmire, and maybe he got outed, maybe he was in trouble for some other reason, but that he knew him. That's the implication, and that is how Doc got carried away with them as well. The implication that he was committed suicide, and that this is the driving trauma in Babe's life, then gives you an insight to why he runs. Why does he run marathons? He says he says to Elsa when he's like, oh, I twisted my ankle. And she says, but you're not limping. Oh, well, if you want to win marathons, you just have to be able to endure pain.
And you don't give in to pain, he says.
You don't give in to pain. And then, of course, as the film carries on, He is put through so much. He is tortured. If your tooth is drilled like that, it doesn't stop hurting as soon as they stop drilling. You can see him still suffering with his tooth throughout the film. He's not sleeping. He's hurt in all kinds of ways, and he has kind of run a marathon, and he has had to do things he never thought that he would ever do. He has to endure all this pain, and I wonder if one of the driving forces is he saw his father, out of maybe he presumes weakness, kill himself rather than deal with consequences, than deal with something unpleasant. So he thinks, I can't be like my father. I have to be able to endure anything. And that is the mindset that helps him survive.
Also, Doc does something like that because he gets stabbed somewhere in the downtown part of New York, I guess, and stumbles all the way back to Babe's apartment, which Zell brings up when he's torturing him. I think it's the second time when Janeway's brought Babe back and when Zell's being more reasonable. And I say being more reasonable because he's not just saying, is it safe? And then you're not telling me the answer. Fine, I'm going to dig in your teeth with these dental picks, these kinds of things. We've all seen those. That would be bad. But when he's being nicer in the second set of torture is when he brings up the drill. And we never see anything except the shot zooms in or something like that. And then you hear Hoffman going, ah! But you were squirming through a lot of those scenes.
Have you ever been to the dentist?
But almost all suggestion because you don't really see anything. I think a modern movie now, if Eli Roth made this movie, and I like some of his films, he's a pretty good raconteur and all that kind of thing, but he would just show everything and it wouldn't be nearly as effective. When you see the ear get cut off in the deleted scene of Reservoir Dogs, it looks dumb, and maybe that's why Tarantino cut it, but you don't need it. You have the guy screaming as the camera pans away, and that's more than enough. And look how long that has lasted in pop culture, almost 30 years. People know what you're talking about when you say the ear scene in Reservoir Dogs. Yeah.
And like all good thrillers, the lead-up is so much more effective than the actual event.
Also, the catch-22 of, is it safe? Is what safe? Is it safe? I don't know what you're talking about. Is it safe? So safe you wouldn't believe it. Is it safe? No, not safe at all. He doesn't know what to say. Yeah. He doesn't know what the guy's even talking about. And also, of course, this plays in the last 15 or so years, I guess almost 20 years now, after 9/11. Jon Stewart joked on The Daily Show it was freedom tickling.
Yeah, they gave torture all these euphemisms. What do they call it? Like accelerated...
Enhanced interrogation techniques.
Freedom tickling, yeah.
And people have said many times over that torture doesn't work, that it doesn't get actionable information. And look what happens with Hoffman. He doesn't know anything. They still keep torturing because they think he knows something. Well, either he does or he doesn't. But how can you trust it when you've done all these things to him? And I think Zell even says that. If he knew something, he would have spoken. But you've already tortured him two different sessions now in the span of a few hours. How do you have faith in that? Now, I've said before that I get why the mentality is whatever it takes, 24. I never even saw that show. But I can understand why a guy on the run with no time, Jack Bauer torturing people to get actionable information because it's all about a 24-hour clock. I can see why you would think that way. But we've heard it over and over again by people in the know, not some jackass on Twitter. That's not going to work because I know, because I've seen a few movies and read a few books. No, these are people in the business of the CIA or who've been around a long time in the military say it just isn't reliable. But I love the fact that you can't win. Either Hoffman tells him, nope, not safe, which he does say. But then, of course, the whole point would be, and Zell never says, why is it not safe? Because the guy doesn't know. And it's one of the better scenes that I think William Goldman's ever written in a movie. I don't think Goldman was all that thrilled with the screenplay for this, or at least the final product of this, or the same year when he did All the President's Men, because the only two screenplays he said he was happy with, or only two movies from his screenplays he was truly happy with, were Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Princess Bride.
Okay, Princess Bride, yes. Butch Cassidy? I know I stand out for not being crazy about that film, but you like that better than All the President's Men as a screenplay goes?
And we covered Misery late last year. Maybe he doesn't have a problem with the work that was done by Rob Reiner on Misery, but that's another one you think that would maybe be in his list. I've read the Misery book. It's pretty close to what happens in the movie.
So I want to go back to the torture scene and to go back to the theme of injustice.
It is safe to do so. Go ahead.
What Babe goes through is a microcosm of what the victims of the Holocaust went through. Through no fault of his own, he's stalked and kidnapped, tortured for no discernible reason, confused about their motivations why, totally helpless to stop the torture and get out of danger. He watches his brother die, watches his family die under the hands of these twisted psychos. People who appear to be trustworthy turn out to be turncoats who will sacrifice his safety to look out for themselves.
Elsa,
and also Janeway. And all along, there are these bigger forces using Babe as a disposable pawn to reach their own ends. Whether it's altruistic or greedy and selfish, it doesn't really matter to Babe, who has no stake in the outcome of their fight. So Naturally, he's furious, he's distressed, helplessly trying to simply save himself. There's something so visceral about his predicament because he's a protagonist who truly did nothing to deserve all this trauma. He is a babe in the woods. He is a true innocent. It mirrors the helplessness we feel when the powers that be make the heinous decisions that hurt people, and there are no consequences because we think it's more important for the stock market to go up a few points than for people to experience safety and comfort.
Safety especially, we should all feel safe in the world.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have his father who experiences injustice. Doc, on some level, experiences injustice.
Also meted it out, though, by the sounds of it. He wasn't clean at all.
No, he truly wasn't clean. Not to say he deserved what he got, but he was an assassin. How do assassins die? They don't die peacefully in their bed at the age of 80. Apparently, there's a thing in the book about how he understood that about himself, and he didn't want to die like an assassin. He wanted to die with somebody who loved him, and he was coming to terms with the choices that he'd made and how he couldn't really experience human relationships properly. So that is the feeling that motivated him to go to his brother's apartment when he knew he was dying. It wasn't to tell him anything.
He doesn't actually say anything, does he?
I think he says his name. I think he says Babe. It's truly like a personal experience that he's just dying and he wants to go see his brother. They really love each other. It's actually sweet that they have this chemistry and this affection towards one another.
Yeah, the two guys only have, I guess, a couple scenes. One of them is in the restaurant when Elsa's lying about what she knows about Switzerland, because Doc makes up a bunch of stuff. And then when she's, oh yeah, that, the skiing and all that stuff. I made all that up. What are you talking about? He's an expert spy and, as you said, an assassin too, for that matter. And then in some ways, at that point at least, because it gets a lot worse, ruins his brother's life because his brother now doesn't really trust Elsa despite their passionate affair. But then she was always a plant. They're lucky that he was into her, because if he wasn't, then what happens? What if he didn't think she was hot or cool, or maybe he was racist or something like that against Europeans?
Did you not see the blouse that she was wearing when they first met?
Yeah, fair enough. That's true.
Yeah, she had a pretty see-through blouse and no bra on.
But you mentioned Scheider's role in this movie. In the sequel book, Brothers, in 86, so about 12 years after the first book, Doc survives. And I read through the Wikipedia entry. It sounds like he survives till the end of that book, too. And then he and Babe are reunited after whatever they went through in that one. Beyond that, I don't know how he survived, because we see him dead. It's made extremely clear. But as far as what you just said about what happens with Babe and all that's happened before in the span of a few days in this movie, I guess is what it's supposed to be. Well, probably weeks, but it's not months anyway. So what happens next? Babe first goes to the dentist. Let's hope he has coverage, because he's going to need some help.
A student, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not. Then he enters a marathon, finishes ninth.
Respectable.
He lost the run battle earlier in the movie. Wasn't even all that close, and the guy's taunting him, and he tries to catch him and can't. I don't know why that's really in the movie, other than to give Hoffman more time to run. One of the many famous stories in this movie is that Hoffman had to be Mr. Character Actor, Method Actor, I should say, and he would run before a scene where he was supposed to be out of breath to make himself out of breath, which I guess makes some sense. You hear about some things the Method Actors do. That's a pretty reasonable one. Why not?
And his performance is outstanding. Whatever he had to do to get there, kudos.
He got in great shape, too, in the mid-70s. This is their version in the 70s of being cut. This is such a New York movie. It was shot in New York, obviously. Some of it in California, some also in Paris. I wasn't really entirely clear on where Doc fits in, because I thought Doc is the one that gets that little Band-Aid box from Zell's brother in the opening, well, not the opening scene, but the first scene with Zell's brother when he goes in the safety deposit box and gets out the diamonds. And of course, there's a lot more of them beyond that, because Doc has them later. But he was supposed to have been in Paris. Doc was, I think, the whole time. And yet that happened in New York. So I'm not really sure who took the diamonds. It could have been one of the henchmen.
Well, the plot is not particularly sensical. Kind of goes all over the place, and if you try to put all the pieces together after the credits roll, well, you're going to be disappointed. So it's best to just not think too hard about it. Let it wash over you. You're never going to be able to make sense of everything. And that is definitely one of those things.
I think Roger Ebert said that in his review as well. He talked about how the movie's a good thriller, maybe even a great thriller, but you can't really analyze it too closely or else it's going to fall apart in big ways.
Yeah, right from the beginning, it's really masterful in its suspense. Even before you have any investment in the characters, you're really on the edge of your seat. Schlesinger wasn't reinventing the wheel here, but there's a mastery here that is incredibly effective. I will add, though, that the first act is way too long. The movie's too long, but I think all of the dead weight is in the first half of the film.
Well, there may be too much of Doc, even though Rorschach is really strong in the movie. He's also in great shape.
It takes too long for the brothers to find each other and for the audience to learn what their connection is.
But he probably wanted to show off being in great shape, though, as I just said a second
ago. As he should.
By being half naked. He's in only underwear when he has that big fight.
When he's doing the push-ups?
Yeah.
Hello.
with his feet up on the top of the bed.
Yes.
Bed frame.
He is a man who wants to watch the strike from his patio, and he goes out there in his underwear.
That's in Paris, though, too. Of course, Europe is known for having more protests and strikes than America is.
And I guess, like, a more lenient attitude towards public nudity.
It's also fitting that he was one of the stars of The French Connection, because that movie starts in France, and then almost all of it is set in New York. And this movie has some scenes in France with him. And then, of course, most of it is in New York.
And another great thriller from the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Which made the AFI list. Also, it's an interesting touch that Doc does say to the woman that walks through a park, I guess in France. I thought it was in New York, but it's supposed to be in France. Because the clerk has murdered the opera. A lot of murders lead up to all this stuff. And he says to that woman walking through, it's not safe. And then we'll be talking 25 minutes later. Is it safe? Is it safe? Is it safe?
Now, I assumed that woman was the person that he was talking to on the phone earlier. He's in his hotel room and he says, hey, why don't you come over here? I miss you. And when he connects with her later, I was like, oh, that must be the woman that he was talking to. They never really pay off that. But I'm wrong. Do you know who it was?
No.
Janeway. So in the book, it's explicit that...
He's gay.
They're gay. They're a couple. They have a relationship. On the phone, he says, Janie, why don't you get over here? I miss you.
That's interesting because, of course, John Schlesinger was, I think, out as a gay man.
Huh.
If not his whole career, then at least some of it.
They talk about this in The Celluloid Closet, that there would be gay characters in film, but you'd have to really look for it. You'd have to have this eagle eye and see these little hints that directors and writers and actors might put in there because the studio would never allow them to make it explicit, but this must be one of those things. And it's kind of refreshing in the sense that, yeah, Janeway is certainly a villain, but Doc, while he's not perfect, he's kind of a hero of the film. He's certainly a sympathetic character. He doesn't fit into that, what's the word for the phrase, the queer villain, the...
Well, no, because he is a heroic character because he's on Babe's side and he's doing U.S. government work, but he's extremely shady. Because he's not a hero anyway. He's more of a...
But he doesn't feel like that queer villain in the sense that Scar is a queer villain. That way that Hollywood tends to make villains
gay. Well, obviously,
gay.
Because I didn't know anything about that till right now. Mm-hmm. You told me. Mm-hmm. So
exactly.
Clearly he's not a stereotype if it's that subtle. But yes, even though Scheider's quite strong in the film, maybe there's a little bit too much of him. Because we get the point that there's danger. And then when he is palling around with Hoffman, such good chemistry between those two guys. A bromance, if you will, long before that term was ever used. When he goes into the apartment, and of course Babe does say, I've got a gun, before we know he has a gun. There's some pretty good setup and payoff in this movie, including things like that, and the setup and payoff of, is it safe? Well, when Zell goes through New York City, he's outed by two very old people he must have tortured. The old woman recognizes him.
What an incredible scene.
And then the salesman.
Too.
But they recognize him, so yes, it wasn't safe, but let's say those two had actually cornered him on the street, surrounded by other people. That's the guy who tortured me in the war 30 years ago. Prove it. But then again, another thing we said during the movie is he doesn't want to be recognized by his white hair, why he's called the White Angel. Yes, he does cut it, then he shaves it, and he gives himself a male pattern baldness haircut. Just shave the head, or maybe more so than that, wear a hat and sunglasses.
Yeah, he could definitely do more, too.
Dye the hair, make it black.
Maybe he underestimated how much people would remember him, and there's a moment in that scene where I was like, would they really
recognize
him?
No, he's not. He's saying, is it safe? Although that may be more about the CIA.
I'm talking about the Holocaust survivors. So it's the Diamond District of New York, and Holocaust survivors live there. We see the tattoo on the one guy's wrist, and it's obvious that the woman who's calling him out is also a Holocaust survivor. And it can seem far-fetched that they might recognize him, but actually I feel like that face would be pretty burned into my brain. If that is the man that drilled into my tooth when I wasn't anesthetized... Yeah, I probably would never forget what he looks like. That scene also calls to mind another consistent thing that keeps happening in the movie, which is that people call for help and they never get it. This is a really dire portrait of New York City or city life in general, humanity in general. You have this scene where she's walking down the street desperately asking people to stop him, stop him, stop him, and they're ignoring him until she gets straight up hit by a car, and only then do they pay attention to her, ignoring her pleas.
I thought for a minute she fainted in front of the car, but no, it's supposed to be that she was hit by the car, but the actress, the stunt woman, whatever, was never that close to the car.
Fair enough. So you have that where strangers don't seem interested in helping her at all. You have Babe, when he's being abducted from his apartment, he is screaming bloody murder.
And he's broken the glass.
Help me, help me.
Somebody's got to hear this.
You don't hear sirens. You don't hear anything happening.
Look where he lives, though.
His neighbors aren't helping.
He lives around a lot of black people.
It says a lot about how people behave in this city. When he's running away from them at the end, he's on the highway, he's trying to get a car to stop. They are not stopping for him. In this world that they have created in this film, you are on your own.
Well, this guy is in his pajama bottoms only. It's the reverse of what happens in Fight Club. Norton in Fight Club is wearing something on top, a jacket, that kind of thing, but then his boxers and nothing else lower. Maybe he's got shoes, but he doesn't have any pants on because they
ripped
them off.
He's wearing everything but pants, so you can just see his skinny calves.
Right, okay, because the cops pulled them off. They're part of Project Mayhem. But it's the reverse here, where all Hoffman has on are his pajama bottoms. I think he has shoes, too, for some reason. Maybe just because he's got to run as much as he does. It would be more vivid, actually, if the character is supposed to have no shoes on. But I feel like you see the shoes, and it could just be that they made a mistake because Hoffman actually had to wear shoes to run through New York.
No, I thought he was barefoot, and I say that because I might be getting this wrong, but the two runners that he has the portraits of, framed pictures of in his apartment, one of them is... I would get his name wrong.
One of them, by the way, in the opening video at least, is a black person.
And that guy...
Another subtext.
Yes. Everybody assumes it's Jesse Owens. It's not Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens famously was the black man who won the marathon during the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, which really stuck it to Hitler. You think you're the superior race? Well, guess what? Jesse Owens was a hero for that. But that's not who that is. He's an Ethiopian runner who famously won the marathon in, I think it was the 64 Olympics in Tokyo.
With no shoes?
With no shoes.
What?
There's a whole movement of barefoot runners, people who will run with no shoes because they just think it actually makes you a better runner. And he maybe not necessarily proved it, but he proved that shoes don't necessarily make you better.
Well, Babe is supposed to be shoeless, I believe, but I feel like I saw shoes at one point, and it could just be a mistake because you have to actually put shoes on Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, the actor Dustin Hoffman is going to run in shoes, I get it.
But I wondered at some point if he's actually supposed to have them on. Maybe they, for some reason, gave him shoes to get him to that warehouse.
But when he thinks about his hero, right, this is his hero, this man who ran the marathon barefoot, and what does everybody think of when they think of that? You have to endure a lot of pain. Your feet are feeling every single step. That's pain endurance.
Well, it's fitting that we covered this during the Olympics, like we said already, but it's also fitting that it's not that long after Chris and I posted Without Limits, where Steve Prefontaine runs through anything, including having his foot cut open and winning again.
If you learn about long-distance runners, and then it gets even more extreme with extreme long-distance runners, it's bananas what these people put their bodies through. It's no longer healthy or sane what these athletes do. They destroy their bodies.
Well, of course, Babe is running away from Richard Bright being one of the henchmen, so Al Neary from the Godfather movies plays one of the two henchmen. Run away from those guys, and also Janeway to some degree as well. They're never going to catch him because even with bare feet, if he has bare feet, we think he does, he's just faster than them. So that does pay off the marathoning he's been doing in the early part of the film. But he also says in a letter to Doc that he thinks he could have killed those muggers. Oh, if I could go back, I'd kill those guys. Well, those muggers were the two guys that he deals with through so much of the film, and later on he does shoot them both, although I thought maybe in the editing it looked like, for some reason, Janeway killed the other dude. But regardless, those two guys are shot dead, and also Babe does shoot Janeway, who before that had shot Elsa. So that cottage that Zell's brother had owned is a complete massacre. I'm not sure why anyone else would go out there for a long time, but when they do, they're going to find four dead bodies, and they're going to wonder why they're all out there.
You have to wonder if he's going to walk away scot-free from this. In a way, his connection to all these people is so spurious, and nobody's going to want to tell the story honestly. So could he just go home, go to his apartment, go to sleep, get his window fixed, and go to class on Monday as if nothing happened?
Now, what happens next is it really over? Is it over?
Well, there's a sequel to the book.
Yes, it's over. It's over. Yes, it's over. Is it over?
No, not even close to over.
Is it over? Well, we know Dustin Hoffman's Mr. Method Man, especially by this point, because he has so much power, he could do whatever he wanted to. When we did All the President's Men, I don't recall us talking about how Robert Redford or Alan Pakula, so Redford, it was his movie, a co-star and a producer and all that, and Pakula directed, and Goldman wrote for that matter. But I didn't read, and I don't think we talked about how Hoffman really truly power played things. Maybe he realized in some ways, I'll play ball, I won't do what I do in some other movies, but when I'm the true star of a movie, then I want what I want. In this one, and he's putting himself through this stuff, but in this one, he wanted to be dunked underwater by Richard Bright, and I guess it's Mark Lawrence, those two thugs, as long as possible. Hold me under, see how long I can do it. Well, what if in your struggles, you don't have the right code to say, okay, now I, Dustin Hoffman, can't take anymore. Let me out of this water. And that scene is cut. There's a few cuts in that scene. Maybe they took some of that out too because it was too much for audiences, like the dental stuff and whatever happens with Scheider, because a lot of things were cut out of this film as they went through the previews and then got the movie into the theaters. But he wanted to be method there. And of course, he also wanted to be method. You've heard the story 1,000 times probably if you're a movie fan about how he looked so bedraggled through a lot of the movie and he stayed up for days and days and days. And the response from Laurence Olivier was, my boy, why don't you try acting? The story in the making of that Dustin Hoffman tells is, Olivier apparently said, oh God, the things I've done to myself, as if he right away realized, well, I'm a hypocrite because I pulled all this kind of stuff too. Hoffman said that yes, he stayed up for days, but it's because he was partying. He was going through a divorce from his first wife. So it wasn't just about the movie. It was also because he was being a fairly young, not quite 40-year-old guy, living his life.
And the first half of that story is part of the reason that Olivier was annoyed was because, A, he was doing this film while he was really sick. I can't remember if it was... I think Olivier was sick.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, he almost didn't do the film because he was so ill. He thought it was a bad idea, but then he agreed to do it because the paycheck was big enough that it would have taken care of his family.
And Evans pulled some serious strings. Robert Evans had that much clout. Because Olivier wasn't supposed to be able to be insured, but Evans, there you go. It's a movie version of the Mafia. Well, yeah, but it's Robert Evans. I can make this happen. So, he made an offer they couldn't refuse, the insurance companies.
So he was very sick, but also he was still working really hard, as he always did. And the story goes that he rehearsed the lines over and over. He had done 100 different versions of Is It Safe until he got something he was satisfied with and happy with. So he worked very hard as well. It's not like he was phoning it in and he's just like, try acting, my boy. To him, preparing was a different process. I think a lot of people have disputed that story. It's gotten away from itself and become this legend in Hollywood. But whether the story is true or not, we know that they had two different approaches for doing their job. In your opinion, which is better? Look at their two performances, which are both excellent performances. I think I've already revealed my opinion.
You think Hoffman's even better than Olivier?
I think Hoffman's way better than Olivier. He is so real and raw. It's visceral watching him act in this film. Whereas Olivier is really controlled and there's an extreme charisma and watchability to his performance. He's an excellent villain. His presence cannot be underestimated. But as far as making a film that was raw and realistic and cut to the nerve, Hoffman is the one that delivers here.
I could see Hoffman playing some of the characters he didn't end up playing. Although De Niro is so excellent in Taxi Driver, one of the great Scorsese De Niro joints of all time. But I think Hoffman could have been maybe not as good in a different kind of way. Excellent as well. Dog Day Afternoon, apparently he could have been up for that. Although it's one of Pacino's best works in the entire 70s. Maybe even better than the Godfather performances, really. Bigger, of course. But Hoffman was so good. I've said this before. Hoffman is the guy who was a star at this time, and for many years after this, and many years before this, who was also still mostly a character actor. I said to you also during the screening, William Devane was not as well known as Hoffman. He was eventually in Knots Landing on TV, I think for many years, so maybe a lot of people know him best from that. But we covered him not that long ago in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. To me, a lot of the time, his voice, and especially in close-ups with his teeth and his face, he looks to me and sounds in some ways to me like Jack Nicholson, who's the other one, I would say, from this era, who was a star, but at this point still, not so much in the years that followed, could sink into roles and be a character actor. Jack could. Dustin Hoffman, even the many years after, yes, you knew it was Dustin Hoffman, but he still felt like he could be a true character actor. He's one of those few guys that we've ever really seen in all the years of Hollywood that was a well-known star, made so much money doing all this for a living, but still didn't overtake the role so much. Maybe because it's the whole character actor thing, I'm sure he's a pain in the ass to work with. And I've talked about character acting and method acting lots of times in this podcast. I've probably gone both sides of it where you say, whatever it takes to get the shot done. But then the Daniel Day-Lewis thing, you got to call me Mr. President or I'm going to be in the wheelchair when I'm playing the guys in the wheelchair on my left foot. For God's sakes, how about trying acting like Billy Bob Thornton, Robin Williams, on their dramas, their serious dramas where you see these outtakes in the DVDs where they're joking around seconds before action, they're being goofy, and then they can go from that to, okay, now I can be serious, I want to talk about killing you. There's a part of me that respects that just as much, but in the end, whatever gets the movie made, whatever makes the movie better, and whatever stays in our mind, and I think that's what Hoffman is thinking, is that if this is painful for you on this film shoot, Schlesinger, who we'd work with, of course, method acting as well, in Midnight Cowboy, the famous stories from Tootsie, Hoffman is remembered through all these roles, all the Oscar nominations, two wins, could have had even more than that, and that's one reason I'm glad his legacy isn't truly tainted like some of the other actors are. Like, Spacey's legacy will always be tainted, no matter whatever else he ever does, and apparently he's going to be in another movie one of these days. because of what is in his past, if it's ever proven, and it seems like it might be true. But Hoffman, yeah, he's a great actor in this role, and it's not really one of his true 5 or 10 most famous performances. Maybe 10, but not one of his 5, probably. And that says a lot. And one of the reasons Olivier probably got nominated in this and not Hoffman is it was a strong category, for one thing, for best actor. Olivier, I don't think, had really played a character like this before. And then a couple years later, it turns out, he ends up being the guy who hunts this basic character, because this is a takeoff, this version, Zell, of Joseph Mengele.
Yeah,
and Gregory Peck plays Mengele in The Boys from Brazil, and Olivier is a Jewish Nazi hunter.
Yeah.
So they're both excellent in different kinds of ways. We already talked about Scheider, Devane, the thugs. Marta Keller is pretty strong in her role. Some sexy sex scenes with Dustin Hoffman. It's a convincing film. I'm glad you liked it. I don't love it. I don't think I'm going to watch it again for a long time. I haven't seen it for a long time. It's a little long. It's a little slow because it is the 70s. But it is one of the, I wouldn't say forgotten, but not quite in the same pantheon as other movies of this ilk. Although it is 50th on the top 100 thrills. So it wasn't forgotten when they did that thrills list.
Is it a worse film than The French Connection?
I'd rather watch this again. And I like The French Connection.
I like French Connection, but I'm thinking about that and I'm thinking about this. I think I like Marathon Man better.
So we just talked about Hoffman's credits that we've covered before, at least 7 movies now with this one. Maybe it's more. I may have overlooked something. Olivier we've covered, but it's been a long time, and this is true about Scheider, too. Olivier in Wuthering Heights and Spartacus in the Top 100 Project, and I don't think anything since. So it's been that many years when we did Spartacus. And then Scheider was in The French Connection and Jaws, and we haven't covered him in anything in 6.5 years, because that was Jaws. Talked about Schlesinger directing and Evans producing. Evans, of course, is known for The Godfather and Chinatown. Also, Sidney Beckerman has a producing credit on this, and he produced Red Dawn, the original, from about, 8 years later? And Goldman, as I said, wrote the original book. Goldman's one of the all-time great writers. And apparently Robert Towne did some rewriting on this, which I'm sure Goldman didn't like too much, but that's what happens in Hollywood. And again, without limits, Robert Towne was the writer and director of that. And Chris and I just covered that not long ago, leading into the Olympics. And then Conrad Hall, who shot that movie, Without Limits, and also shot Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, won an Oscar for that, won an Oscar for American Beauty, won an Oscar for Road to Perdition, and now, of course, he's now dead, but he was one of the great cinematographers of all time. This movie looks great the way it's supposed to. Looks grimy and raw,
yeah,
and that kind of
overcast,
thing.
Yeah, overcast, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is one of the first movies they ever did Steadicam.
It's the first theatrical release that had Steadicam in it.
I think Bound for Glory and Rocky were shot first.
After. Yeah, they were shot first, but this was the first one.
All those were the same year, 76. And then, of course, the most famous at that point, so many movies have done Steadicam since, but The Shining, probably even well-known for its Steadicam use than even those movies were 4 years after all these movies from 76. The editor, Jim Clark, won an Oscar for The Killing Fields several years later, and also did a Bond movie, and he's known for working with Mike Leigh. So he's really all over the place with what he's worked on as a cutter. And the composer, this is an effective score. I'm assuming you're going to agree. Michael Small did The Stepford Wives the year before this, and Jaws the Revenge 11 years later.
I do really like this score. I think it has a nice ominous tone to it.
Picking at your teeth a little bit, drilling at your teeth,
yes,
somehow.
Yeah. And thrillers really do need an effective score. So I respect it, and I like it.
What about
I like
the cutting and the look?
It needed another pass with the editing. There's a lot of stuff in the trivia about this film, about how many things they cut out, and it started to feel to me like this was a team that was afraid to kill their darlings. They just couldn't cut any more out. They had to cut out all these things that they really loved because audiences found it too gory, too violent, too upsetting, or because it was too long and too much. But they really did need to do another pass and take out another 20 minutes, I think.
Scheider would have been pissed, but there should have been less Scheider.
I totally agree. I think the beginning, it just takes too long for things to come together so that as the audience member, you're like, oh, this is why I care. I need to know why these disparate stories were going to come together and connect. It just went on for a little too long. A great way to introduce the stories, but they indulged in too much stuff with Scheider, I agree. Which is a shame, because that stuff is some of the best stuff in the movie, so I know why it was hard to cut, but just for the sake of turning this film that I think just about everybody agrees is a solid B+. To get it to an A+, that could have put it over the edge.
Okay, fair enough. Last thoughts then on Marathon Man.
I'm so glad I finally saw this movie. It's not perfect, like we said, but it's so suspenseful and engaging. Performances terrific across the board. Everybody's wonderful in this movie. And it really puts you in the time and the place and the mood of the mid-1970s.
The poster sure isn't wrong. It's a thriller. It's funny to see that. A thriller.
I love the poster with the gradient text coming down.
Version of Cool Hand Luke you see in another Norton movie, 25th Hour. Where he's got the Cool Hand Luke poster with the various Newmans that stretch across the scene rather than down the screen.
So cool.
Yeah, the torture scenes are vivid still, even now. And the whole movie is a sense of paranoia from start to finish. And the music is a big part of the reason why for that. A lot of 70s thrillers did. Parallax View had some of that same thing going on. The Warren Beatty, Pakula movie that they shot in 74. The 70s were an excellent decade for so many things, but thrillers is one of the ones I think people sometimes overlook. Because, of course, Jaws, in the end, is really more of a thriller. I guess a creature film than a true horror film.
In its technique, it's a thriller.
This is, yeah. And we could go
over
the
list. And Jaws, I mean.
Oh, Jaws is, yeah. One of the great things about the 70s is it's got a lot of thrillers that sometimes we don't remember at the top of the list of the top 50 or 100 movies from that decade. This is somewhere in there, I would say. It's far from perfect, but the performances are strong and it's incredibly watchable. Even the dental scenes. I was okay with it.
It's worth it.
Because I've seen it many times. Okay, that's it for a marathon, man. In 7 days, we'll do what we do so often and take a hard left turn in tone as we get away from the death and killing to talk about a cult classic comedy, Harold and Maude, a movie in which the main character repeatedly tries to kill himself. We're not getting away from death and killing at all. And this is a comedy. The coming attraction's opinion question. What's your favorite movie where the main character tries to commit suicide?
All right, so for our answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Harold and Maude. And for more from us, visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles. On top of that, in exchange for all this content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. That helps people find us. We are both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project for a 20% discount. That's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive.
Spoiler alert at the end of the podcast, it wasn't safe.
And cut.